American culture is ubiquitous across the globe. It travels to different social contexts and is consumed by international populations. But the relationship between American culture and the meanings attached to the United States change over time. During the 20th century, the American century, American culture generally aided in the positive global perception of U.S. policies and governance. And after the American century, the ends of U.S. culture in the Middle East, Brian Edwards demonstrates how this relationship altered in recent decades. Technological innovation and the emergence of the digital age have drastically changed the nature of cultural circulation and production. Edwards explores the innovative play between global culture and local subjects in Egypt, Iran, and Morocco. He explores the exchange and interpretations between multiple publics that engage culture situated within various assumptions and social expectations. What he shows is that local cultural production often creates the ends of circulation, which are not always visible to an American audience. In our conversation, we discuss the relationship between culture and politics, Egyptian fiction and graphic novels, Iranian directors Asghar Farhadi and Abbas Kiarostami, Shrek, digital piracy, Moroccan film controversies, the logics of film production, interpreting audiences, American Orientalism in television, literature, and Ben Affleck's Argo. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Brian Edwards about his great new book, After the American Century. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you doing?
Hi, Christian. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this book, After the American Century, The Ends of U.S. Culture in the Middle East, was really fascinating. It's super exciting to read this kind of academic book because you bring in lots of different kind of genres of writing, which I think, for at least for me as a reader, kept me really engaged and kind of wanting to learn more. And but you also really offer a lot of, I think, theoretical kind of methodological nuggets that I think will be useful for lots of people. So thanks for writing a great book.
Well, thanks for the kind words. It was in process for a while, so I'm happy to have the chance to talk about different aspects of it.
Sure. Now, it's always our tradition to start with a little bit about our authors. So could you tell us a little bit about your background, maybe your part of your training? What brought you to the study of Muslim societies?
That's a great question. I think I have an unusual route to writing this book and the work that I'm doing now. I went to graduate school in the 90s, and I pursued a PhD in American studies, which I'm proud to say. I started by writing a dissertation that led me in this direction, which was conceived of really in the wake of the first Gulf War. When I was starting to go into an American studies program, at which I did at Yale, the richness of American studies, I thought, was the kind of collision of different disciplines, particularly literature and history and a sort of social sciences approach. In the mid-90s, I was looking for, well, actually, I should say when I first got into graduate school, it was in the wake of the Gulf War, or the 1991 Gulf War. I was living in New York between college and graduate school, and kind of dismayed by the way that war was being portrayed in the media, especially in TV and broadcast media. I hadn't yet studied the region. I had barely been to it. And there, a couple of things happened at the same time. There was that military conflict and the way it was reported, on the one hand, and this, on the other hand, there was the release of the Bertolucci's film, The Sheltering Sky, which was based on Paul Bowles' 1949 novel. It took 40 years for that to be made into a film. It brought to another generation attention to a novel that for many people was kind of a version of American Orientalism. For others, it was, kind of the last gasp or of a sort of colonial expatriation. it also spurred on a lot of cultural attention for another generation of thinking about North Africa in exactly those sort of Orientalist ways that we are familiar with as scholars from previous decades. In any case, those two things came together, and I was sort of casting about, looking for a project, went to graduate school thinking I was going to write about the collision of literature and architecture and architectural space. Of course, this is in the 90s. We were starting to discover as scholars what it meant to think about globalization in the decade after the end of the Cold War, what we thought the end of the Cold War, started to be work thinking about nationalism in different sorts of ways, national identity. Of course, work by Benedict Anderson became hugely important to people in graduate school in the 1990s. And then in my own interdisciplinary field, there was really this starting to be people who were thinking about the United States as and its culture and history in an international context in ways that that were perhaps new for that generation. And what that meant was also sort of a more multilingual or international approach to research itself. In any case, I went to Morocco in the summer after my first year of my PhD program. Really out of a sense of curiosity, I think. I would definitely say motivated as much by a fascination with this film, The Sheltering Sky, which had been filmed all through Morocco and Algeria, as well as, you know, a kind of political sensibility that there was something wrong about how Americans were writing about in mainstream ways the quote unquote the Arab world. You know, and at that point I traveled just using French and Spanish, which were languages that I felt comfortable with. I hadn't yet started even to learn Arabic. And I, you know, quickly met up with peers of mine who are Moroccan peers, who just the sort of embrace and warmth and conversations and engagement that I felt right away. I felt immediately at home and interested to spend more time there. And as you know, and as I think graduate students, I hope, know, the choice to do work should emerge from a combination of a sort of intellectual and potentially political commitments, but also there's choices that you make, and I feel like I've made them a couple times in my career, which will have huge and long lasting effects on how you end up spending your life, where you spend it, and the people you spend it with, and that was one of those. So I returned the following summer to really start intensively studying Arabic. I returned the following year to live in Morocco. And at that point, I was doing a dissertation in the middle years of the 1990s. I finished my PhD in 1998. That was really, I would say, a kind of American Orientalism project, looking at the American writers who had, whether they were literary, Paul Bowles played a role, but it went back to Edith Wharton and other writers from earlier decades. And into other disciplines, especially anthropology, from many decades of the 20th century, and cinema became important. I finished that dissertation, and along the way, I had not only gotten much more knowledgeable about and comfortable with the Moroccan literary and cultural and academic scene, which I did. And of course, from that point, Morocco became a very central part of my own life and education and friendships and the friends that I made back in 1993 or 94 in particular. You know, now, of course, are my friends of almost a quarter of a century, and some of my deepest and longest friendships. And we've all sort of gone through not just personal lives together, but also intellectual discoveries and conversations and collaborations. So that idea of collaboration has become central not only to my life and academic career, the way I try to conduct it and where I get sustenance, but it's also been one of the major ideas that I've tried to explore, particularly in my first book. So that dissertation, you know, was finished, and I it had the title of Morocco Bound, which I was happy to say more about. I did end up publishing a first book called Morocco Bound, and have certainly drew on the material that I was had worked on through the dissertation. But when I finished the dissertation and got the degree at the end of 1998 and started working as an assistant professor. I had talked to some publishers and found that there was interest in publishing the book relatively as it is. My dissertation committee liked it as it was for the most part. And I might have done that. And I was spending some time revising it the way I was still in the framework of the first book. Doing the research. And then with the events of September 11th in 2001, I found, almost to my surprise and frustration, that the kinds of questions that people were coming back to ask me then, as if the work, which seemed, I realized retrospectively, seemed to many as being somewhat obscure to think about how the United States had thought about the Arab world. And I'll give you a sentence of what I think that book is about. It really reoriented the work in a bit, in a sort of profound way, although at the time I resisted the idea that it should have. So in my first book, Morocco Bound, I really think of that as a cultural history of how Americans came to think about the Arab world, or the quote unquote, the Arab, via readings of and a combination of cultural history and literary analysis of some of the major texts between World War II and the mid 1970s. So the subtitle of the book is called Disorienting America's Maghreb from Casablanca to the Marrakesh Express. And the reference to cinema and music and popular culture is not incidental. Of course, they refer to the period of time between World War II, 1942, when Casablanca comes out, until the mid-1970s, what I call the end of the hippie Orientalism of the anthropologists and young journalists and writers and cookbook writers and hippies who were in Morocco in the 1970s while the Vietnam War was going on far to the east, and during that book, doing the research for that book to look deeply at the ways in which the United States popular culture and literary and cinematic culture had thought about, often fantasized about, imagined and represented even in political media. North Africa, and then parts of the Middle East outside of the major locations, but even places like Iraq, in cinema and journalism, was such a fascinating and kind of fantastical array of really what you'd have to call a popular American Orientalism, that when September 11th came about. And scholars outside of Middle East studies, of course, or religious studies, were turning to me and saying, well, this is very surprising, this collision of this kind of cultural collision that we're seeing and reading about. I was so taken aback that it definitely changed my work and made me realize that there really had been a cultural history worth thinking about.
And this book, After the American Century, seems almost as a sequel of sorts to your first book in many ways, and really only could be written by somebody like you who has kind of processed the region and these kind of cultural products for such a long time. Can you help us think about some of the key points you're making here in the book? Many that come through right in the title. So one, this idea of the American century, which places us in a kind of temporal perspective. But then I think probably the more interesting part is this idea of the ends of U.S. culture in the Middle East, which refers to the ends of circulation. So can you help us think about what's new after the American century, and how can we think about the ends of circulation in terms of culture?
Sure, absolutely. First, on the first point that you make, that this book becomes a sort of sequel, that there's some truth to that. you often discover in the writing of a first book the really interesting question that you want to pursue as your big question. And as I mentioned, in finishing that first book, Morocco Bound, which was published in 2005, you know, along the way of what was a decade of time spent intensively in the Maghreb, mostly in Morocco, a couple of things were happening. One is, you know, one was on the topic of an American Orientalism, or an idea of representing the Arab world in ways that would have political or cultural significance back to the United States. I found myself surprised at the sorts of responses or recalibrations among Maghrebi and particular Moroccan cultural producers themselves. In other words, back in the 90s and then the 2000s, one of the most powerful prevailing ideas about how cultural representations circulate was something like cultural imperialism, a misreading of Said's use of that term, but an idea that culture itself, cultural products, representations were a kind of imperialism that circulated around the world. That was what the prevailing idea was. What I found, so to speak, on the ground was quite a bit different. I found, and this is what leads to this book, which is that in the 90s and 2000s, many Moroccan academics, anthropologists, filmmakers, writers, in fact, weren't necessarily responding with hurt feelings the way cultural imperialism would imply. In fact, it was a much more complicated way that they engaged American cultural forms. Casablanca, for example, the film, a pure fantasy in most ways, or mostly pure fantasy about what Morocco might be like at a certain point in time, was not for most Moroccans insulting. In fact, there was a playful way in which cinema filmmakers in Morocco, other lesser kind of cultural producers like the makers of cafes and Boya People Decorated Place were playing with it. The text was circulating. They were making new meanings of it for their own purposes, their own national purposes. That was the kind of discovery that I only was barely able to touch in the first book. 2005, that book was published, and I was lucky enough to quickly get a surge to try this new book, which is namely that I was nominated for and ended up winning a Carnegie Scholar Award under the Islam Initiative from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which basically was allowing scholars to try out much more ambitious ideas, ideas that might not find themselves, I would say, in the disciplines or the way that they're working. I was really literally finishing the first book when I had the opportunity to propose a new one. Opportunity, I had only begun to think of what was next. So I came up with this wild idea, this wild proposal of looking at precisely circulation. Well, let me say more about what that meant. But the wild idea was to try to do a multi-sided. I had picked four sites in which I would look at the way that American cultural products made their way through the Middle East and North Africa. Now, why would that be? And what people were doing with them, saying about them, responding to them, and making them anew, let's say, in those sites. Originally, the sites were going to be Morocco, in particular Casablanca, which of course I knew quite well, Cairo, which I knew just a little bit at that point, and Iran and Tehran in particular, which I knew only from afar. And that was on purpose. There was a fourth site, Beirut, which I actually pursued for quite a while in the research and then dropped as a site of major attention in the book. And for a long time, the working subtitle included Casablanca, Cairo, and Tehran in it. So those were, if you look at the book, you know, there's three chapters that are really not case studies. They get a little bit more wild than that. But one of them is focused on each of those three contexts: Cairo, Casablanca, and Tehran. And the idea of circulation emerges out of this idea of what would cultural imperialism, so to speak, or Orientalism look like in the digital age. What had happened between 1990, let's say from the 90s into the mid 2000s, of course, was that the digital revolution had really kicked in deeply. The arrival and the ubiquity of the internet, of cell phone technology, of digital technologies through satellite television, those three examples in particular, and then the arrival of what we call Web 2.0 and a kind of interactive internet by the mid 2000s in the places that I was living in or studying or traveling to, had profoundly changed not only life on the ground for people as it had in the United States and everywhere around the world, but it had also fundamentally changed, I believed or I hypothesized, how representations like Orientalism would work in the present. Of course, it's a moving target to study the present and the way that the technologies with which kind of, you know, dominate our world. I'm talking to you right now via Skype, not possible. You know, we could have talked on the phone, of course, but the ways in which I can talk to you and communicate with you are, of course, profoundly different from what they were like back in the 1990s when I first started spending time in Morocco. The impact of digital technologies on questions of the nation, of censorship, of access to materials, of the way we communicate and network with each other were, of course, profoundly different in the time that I was writing that first book. And there was a reason that that first book had ended in the mid-1970s, and I only then was able to talk about it a little bit at that point in 2005, which was namely that I believed that the mid-1970s is when what we call, in quotes, globalization as a phenomenon, as a cultural phenomenon, really kicks in. And representations such as the ones that Edward Said had written about in Orientalism, and then in my much more modest work looking at American Orientalist texts, have been looking at in the American context, really had to function differently, I thought, when we engage with films, television, even reading itself within a different context. I went so far as to think of it as a new epistemology, that there's an epistemology of the digital age. And it's what led to this project itself, or at least the starting point for this project itself.
Now, if I could just push you a little bit more about the kind of methodological, because I think that's one of the really significant contributions of the book. Part of what you set up here in as you kind of work through your material, specifically in your first chapter revolving around Egypt, is this idea of jumping publics. And I think this gets back to the complications when we think about circulation versus influence and where the ends of these cultural products land. So can you talk a little bit about this idea of various publics that are involved and kind of how we should think about moving across this kind of global transnational context in which the digital age has more easily produced?
Yes. One of the premises of the idea of a public that has influenced my thinking here is that it is drawn in part from the work of Michael Warner, and is the idea that when a writer or a speaker, you might say someone who addresses an audience, even a religious, even a preacher, a poet, when someone makes an utterance or writing, they are imagining and calling into being a public that they may not know, that must include strangers. So it's related to the idea of an imagined community or a sort of a national newspaper. But that there are, after all, in the original idea, that there are limits to even a very large public that one imagines. So if you think about a Hollywood, the different, you know, the anything from a Hollywood film to campaign rhetoric, when people are speaking in traditional terms before the digital age, of course, there's a one would like to think that the audience is endless and that it's infinite. But in fact, that's not really the way creative utterances work. There's some imagined bounded community. It may be bounded by language or some range of imagination that ultimately does have an end. What happens in the digital age, in part because of the technologies themselves, is that some forms of utterance, some forms of representation, can more quickly jump outside the publics that are imagined by their producers. Now, the quickly part is important here, because if the digital age arrives starting in, you know, let's say the 70s or 80s, really the 80s and 90s, and then is really in full force by the 90s and 2000s, it's not as if there wasn't international broadcasting and transnational broadcasting in what we'd have to call the analog age. In fact, the use of audio cassettes, for example, by the Ayatollah Khomeini is well known, in which sermons were being recorded and mass produced and distributed. The Voice of America, for example, that the United States created and transmitted and multiple translations into different languages of propaganda, of course, is also something that precedes the digital age. It's not as if Hollywood films didn't make their way around the world. In fact, I talk a little bit about an illegal archive in downtown Tehran that I was able to visit, in which films that had been kind of rescued or stolen, depending on how you want to think about it, from the major Hollywood studios screenings back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, but had been secreted away in some basement archives in Tehran, are examples of how cinema in the analog age did, of course, circulate transnationally. The idea of jumping publics, however, brings in the acceleration and the unpredictability that that digital replication, piracy, and propagation really allow for, and leads us to all sorts of situations that I find kind of fascinating and spend a lot of time in the book talking about, where new publics, new interpretive, new creative publics, take up a work, in this case, very often American or examples from global cultures that travel, that have some charisma to them, and make it their own. One of the examples that has been easiest to give as an example of this was the example of the dubbings, often illegal dubbings, exuberant dubbings of the CGI film Shrek and other CGI Hollywood films that I, you know, encountered in Iran and use as an example of what happens when jump publics, but it need not be so so literal as that.
Yeah, and in the chapter where you're focused on Cairo, you do this through a number of different literatures and different kinds of genres. Can you talk a little bit about how this works out in the Egyptian context more specifically?
Sure. What happens in the Egyptian context, there's a couple of things. First of all, I come to each of these contexts with a sort of a problem or a nagging idea here. And one was that in the new Egyptian novel of the first decade of the century, of the 2000s, some of the young novelists who are publishing their first works were doing things that people said you shouldn't be able to do, or Western critics in particular were saying shouldn't be able to be done in the Arabic novel. For example, not just a bringing together of Amiya or dialect Arabic with Fusha or more classical Arabic, but also bringing in a text messaging language, a very dynamic references to the digital scene, a kind of breaking apart of the language itself, in expressing what one of the prominent writers of this group called the sensibilities of what he called the "I've got nothing to lose" generation, So I came across a novel that many people who were reading in contemporary Egyptian literature had come across, Antakun Abbas al-Abd, or Being Abbas al-Abd by Ahmed al-Aidi, and read it and felt that it was breaking a lot of rules. Of course, that made me interested in it. And I started following not just al-Aidi, but then writers that were surrounding him, and so through a sort of snowballing research method, asking writers who they were reading, kind of started to learn about an entire young scene of writers, whether they're dialect poets, creative nonfiction writers, novelists, graphic novelists, and comic artists, filmmakers, who were, but especially in these printed forms, who were speaking to each other, who were influenced by a range of global cultural forms and objects, from comic books, spy novels, to television shows, from both Egypt and the Middle East, but also the United States and abroad, who are downloading, downloading Hollywood films and deeply conversant with them, and then creating an exciting new literature. That was exciting not only because it was dynamic in itself, but it was gathering increasing audiences, and they were kind of creating their own public, quite of a large public. One of the nonfiction writers, Khalid Kassab, had a column in El Dustur newspaper, which was called Darbat al-Shams, and he had all sorts of young writers who were in their 20s, sometimes even in their teens, who were publishing work there, and huge following of readers, to the point when he finally shut down left his editorial role. He had a massive protest that he wanted to come back. These are all writers who of course are publishing and creating gatherings in the decade leading up to the Tahrir or January 25th uprisings. So there was, what made me interested about that scene was both how it was kind of turning or diverting from the literary scene in Egypt that preceded it, but also that it was a literature that engaged with the new transnational technologies, or sorry, the new transnationalism that technologies made possible. It didn't look like a national literature the way we had been taught to read national literatures. And that made it very exciting for me. Now, what happens, of course, with the Tahrir uprisings and the eventual departure of Mubarak, is that the role of digital technologies themselves and social media becomes celebrated in the Western press, which has its own story that I talk about in the chapter itself. To the in a way that sort of co-opts the very energy of a lot of these writers and reduces it in a sense to something that was only about the digital. So I don't want to be misunderstood, but really what I'm in saying that this was only interesting because of its digital component, not at all. It was to understand how a much more dynamic cultural and literary scene in Egypt than Western critics were understanding, and often even Egyptian critics, mainstream critics were understanding, but the international story about Egyptian literature had seen was happening right there on the ground. And as you know, this was in the context in the United States of a deeply Orientalist novel about the stasis in the Middle East, the cultural stasis in the Middle East. It's that nothing so contemporary or fresh as we were actually seeing could ever be possible based on the then prevailing narratives in American media, even in scholarship outside of cultural studies, really.
As you move to Iran, you also move more fixedly on cinema. And you think about both kind of specific films and how they revolve around certain publics or forget or don't think of publics that are going to be viewing these films, but also more in the sense of how do these audiences then think and interpret these cinematic cultures. So Where do the ends of circulation fit in relation to American cinema about Iran, Iranian cinema as it's received in Euro-American context? What were you trying to do in this chapter, I guess?
So it has seemed to me, and it seemed to me for some time, that there are two aspects of Iranian culture, let's say, culture in quotes, that circulate to the United States. And one is political rhetoric, obviously overwhelms the second, and the second is cinema. It's been true for decades now that the art cinema of Iran has been one of the most celebrated international cinemas globally. In Chicago, where I am, I think we're up to 30 years of an annual Iranian film festival. There's festivals in Los Angeles dedicated to Iran and so on. Within film worlds, much smaller than the larger mainstream public, Iranian cinema has been known to be one of the greatest for a couple decades now. And I was interested in those two different circulating aspects of Iran, kind of an image, both of them related to media, of course, one deeply political and caught up in, you know, a sort of Orientalism and stereotyping and kind of simplification of what was being said, and the other in the realm of art. We're speaking this morning, the morning after the Academy Awards in 2017, when Asghar Farhadi won for the second time Best Foreign Language Film for his film The Salesman. He had won for A Separation, which I write about in detail in the book, but not only as a text that thinks about the questions of circulation, but for the ways in which the discussion of Iranian cinema, both in the United States and in Iran, cannot, unfortunately, leave the political behind. So what I did in the case of Iran was two things. The time that I spent in Tehran was focused on what I call the film worlds of Iran, how it was that people, not just filmmakers and the text itself, what was being represented on the screen, which might be a more traditional form of film analysis, but more how those films functioned within contemporary Tehran, discussions about society, about art, and about politics. And it turns out that a couple of things. One is that it's very difficult to leave the political behind, even in the work of some of the most apparently apolitical filmmakers. Before Farhadi became a two-time Academy Award winner, the most famous Iranian filmmaker in art worlds was Abbas Kiarostami, the maker of A Taste of Cherry, most famously perhaps, Close Up, and a number of just masterpieces of art cinema, winner at Cannes and so on. Kiarostami, who just passed away last year, made films that would be hard to be called political, except in some second or third order way. Very philosophical films, beautiful films that have long takes. You know, where you watch a child run across a field for several minutes. And Kiarostami became the darling of the art cinema worlds. I was surprised when he was. An interview with him in the New York Times Magazine, one of those one page, 20 questions type of interviews ran, in which Deborah Solomon asked him almost entirely questions about politics and political filmmaking, when his films seemed not to be political really at all. And it just one example of how it's very difficult to leave behind politics when talking about Iranian, even Iranian art cinema. So this is the question that I was asking. At the same time as Asghar Farhadi was emerging and really following in the footsteps of the great tradition of people like Kiarostami and Mahmoud Baf and Jafar Panahi, Ben Affleck's film Argo was produced and distributed, and it itself won an Academy Award for Best Picture. Argo was generally considered in the United States, a bit more of a liberal film, I suppose. It began with a liberal prologue that told the story of the U.S. involvement in the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 in a way that generally in American popular discourse is not told. In other words, a bit closer to what we know, scholars know to be the case of U.S. involvement in that overthrow, and certainly what Iranians know, have known to be the case for decades. Although the film itself ends up being a more conservative film in the sense that it becomes about the heroic rescue of American hostages, a kind of a small, lesser-known story that revolved around the hostage crisis of 1979-1980. So in its content, it's a bit more conservative. But for the most part, in American theaters, it was seen to be a film a little bit more left of center. What I write about and what I was fascinated by was the huge protest against that film in Iran, and not just from the expected circles, to say a more government kind of protest against the film, but really across the board, including people in the opposition in Iran and cultural opposition, cultural left, reformists, and so on. Across the board, people felt very dismayed about Argo, and certainly officially as well as unofficially, which I determined based on looking at a kind of a variety of sources, including interviews, but also blogs, Persian language blogs, kind of unofficial media, as well as more official responses to the thing. So really to look at cinema in Iran and in the context of circulation is to see both how the films themselves, so important both for Hollywood and for Iran, their own cinema and our own cinema, and now places such as Ben Affleck's Argo or Asghar Farhadi's A Separation, as among other works, how they represent the very question of circulation out of Iran into Iran for both films, and to see how that's a very contested place. And how it might help us to understand the cinema itself differently. When we think of the films I'm talking about are films that are projected onto in theaters, but it's absolutely the case that most people now, in both contexts, are watching their films not in cinemas, but in digital versions, whether they're pirated copies or on streaming video, or streaming audio, whether they're watching them in cinemas or more likely on iPads or cell phones even. And so really we have an older form, the feature-length film, colliding with an entirely different episteme, really, which is what I'm calling the digital age. Add that, as the more I spent time in Iran and thinking about and talking to people involved with a more capacious sense of what it means to look at Iranian cinema, including namely the pirated, redubbed versions of films such as Shrek that I mentioned earlier, and then other films that talked about from an Iranian context, that talked about the impact of American culture on Iran, I was trying to open up what's already a very rich discussion about Iranian cinema to a larger template.
And the last region, as you mentioned earlier, is Morocco, where you have the kind of deepest roots in terms of your own experience. And this has one of the, I think, probably the best examples, at least from my reading, of this kind of jumping publics and the ends of circulation in terms of understanding and the ability to interpret. You look at a figure named Hamada and his digital production work of pirated material. I tried to track some of this down, and I was able to find it. And like your friends said at the party, I wasn't really able to understand what was going on here. So, can you? I mean, it might be difficult, but can you tell us what is going on with his work and kind of the limitations and possibilities of interpretation here?
In the chapter on Morocco, which I had a lot of fun writing, and to tell you the truth, it's one of those times you write a chapter and you really want to write a whole book. So there's a number of subsections in it. One ends up talking about Abdullah Taya, the first openly gay Moroccan novelist, or openly gay autobiographical Moroccan novelist. Talk about a film by a woman named Leila Mirakshi, who made a fascinating film about Casablanca youth that really got a lot of people upset in Morocco because it had a love scene between a young Muslim girl and a young Jewish boy. But I start off this chapter talking about the impact, especially of digital media and the arrival of YouTube in Morocco, and how massive a shift that produced. In the case of Hamada, who I call, I didn't really know what to call him, so I call him a video pirate artist. He was underground, and in the early, the first 2003, 2004, 2005 is when he was briefly very well known. I've talked to young Moroccans since; they haven't heard of him. Hopefully, the ones who are reading the book will go back and excavate him. But for a while, he was on everybody's in everyone's conversations. What he did was he took video clips from the internet, which was now becoming now much more accessible in Morocco, or through DVDs, I believe. And he would take short clips and dub, often from animated films, especially the CGI, computer-generated illustration films. Shrek, again, was very popular with him, and that's how he first became known. But also other Hollywood films. The Mask with Jim Carrey was one. He would take old Disney films, take these clips, and he would dub over them popular music, Moroccan music, or sometimes dialogue in Moroccan Darija, the Moroccan dialect of Arabic, and make what I guess you might call a digital mashup that was very, very popular. Now, first of all, if you watch the stuff, and unless you, even if you know Moroccan Arabic, if you're not Moroccan, it's really hard to, it takes a lot of explaining what's going on, but more why it was funny. It's not hard to see what's going on. You have these two texts, one overlaying the other. But the popularity and the fun and the exuberance that many Moroccans felt with this material, and I, as you say, I tell in the book some stories about people telling me that I just won't understand it, but still, asking each other if they'd seen the latest one, how amazing it was. But that exuberance was really interesting to me. I mean, I guess I hypothesized it had something to do with the fun that you could have with these new technologies, and the idea at that time. Now we're talking about a dozen years ago. And the ways that young Moroccans, young creative Moroccans, might play again with a global culture and make it their own. In some ways, that's what underlies all of it. Of course, the popularity was all at the expense of legality, and the guy himself had to flee or go underground. He was very nervous about what he was doing. He himself never really seemed to have made much money off of it because everyone was pirating everybody else. And this itself, just the way that the texts themselves circulated, now with a different sense of circulation, they made their way around into people's laptops and computers and houses and possession at very low cost is part of the story, too, that there was an arrival of new sorts of digital marketplaces, places in souks, for example, in outside Casablanca, the rise of this very famous kind of souk called Derbe Khalif, which is a digital souk basically outside Casablanca, was part of the story too. But more significantly, I think, and this is now cultural history of the recent past, the arrival and use of technologies, not only digital piracy, but now YouTube, to take outside forms, YouTube as an American product, not just as a technology, but as something that was really created for a different use than it ended up having for all of us, but especially in Morocco in the beginning. What used to, was just a private video sharing platform for people to use, share home videos and so on, very quickly became used in Morocco to make some interesting political interventions, to show examples of police corruption, and also to show examples of, kind of non-normative sexualities being practiced in Morocco. Things that everybody knew about, but both of those topics, but nobody really wanted to talk about. And now we're being shown via YouTube and kind of changing the discussion around the country. So that's an example that, as you say, maybe the most tangible one of what I mean by jumping publics. Although in some ways, thinking of YouTube as an American cultural product, the software itself is perhaps a bit more elusive than the traditional cultural products we think of, such as films and literature and otherwise. So throughout the book, I'm really interested in thinking about the circulation not only of individual products like a film, but also cultural forms that become identified with the United States, like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, certain film formulas, the teen movie, and then superhero comics that are a bit more abstract than an individual text that you might see. Reading Lolita in Tehran would be an example of something, although I'm quite critical of that book in itself, but it gives you an example of a more traditional circulating object, the novel Lolita in that case, that people can hold on to. But now we're really entering into the digital age, in which it's not really the individual text that is that's the thing that circulates, but more modes of being and thinking and relating to one another that the digital technologies and software packages that I've named and many others that I haven't are kind of changing the scene quite profoundly. We know that to be the case around ourselves in the United States. Look at the effect of the last of digital technologies and social media platforms on the last presidential election and on the way that we do political, that we, the way that we discourse around politics in the United States today and yesterday and tomorrow. That's been profound. But I think we're also playing catch up. We as scholars of Middle East studies, North African studies, cultural studies, to understand how profound that impact has been on the cultural production and social organization in the Middle East and North Africa.
Yeah, and the book does an amazing job in this regard. And there's lots of great detail, numerous other examples you didn't even mention. So I do hope that people will go out and take a read of the book. Before I let you go, we would love to hear what kind of things you're working on now. I could only imagine with all the kind of tangents that you went on in the book, the avenues you could have explored further. So I'm eager to hear what you're working on, what we might expect from you in the future.
Well, thanks, Christian. Well, first of all, the book comes out in paperback in April, the beginning of April, late March. So people have a chance to, I hope, engage with it there. I'm working on two different projects right now, one of which I'll mention. Both of them are books. And that is to look at that last question I just mentioned, which is the change of political discourse in the United States over the 2016 presidential campaign was not only one that led us to a very different kind of politics that we're now experiencing in the United States in the Trump administration, and you know that's quite obvious, but also the ways in which American culture travels around the world I think has been profoundly affected by this political campaign. One of the assumptions I make in the book, and I question it, is that in the Cold War and the first part of the digital age, consumers of culture in the Middle East and North Africa could negotiate the paradox that American culture might be popular or have some charisma to it, even while U.S. politics was losing its prestige, to put it mildly, in the Middle East during the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan in the first decade. That paradox could be managed by people in the region by separating American politics, which might be negative for them, from American culture, which might be positive. What I'm really interested in, and I started to write about in just at the end of this book and in a couple pieces that came out with its publication, is how American politics and American entertainment now are coming closer to each other. This is through President Trump's unusual form of campaigning, his obsession with social media like Twitter, and the way that the entertainment industry, whether it's the Saturday Night Live or the late night comedy shows or the Academy Awards last night, is also, even in a critical mode, caught up in presidential politics in a way that it really wasn't before. So I'm interested in the global circulation of that, and particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, how it is that that has a profound effect on the way that people engage with American culture, really, and culture and entertainment and as well as politics. Right now, I don't see that as a good development, that that's happening, but I'm really trying to understand how it is. So just today I was looking at, you know, discussions of representations of President Trump in Iranian popular, you know, media, and, you know, some, it's always, again, surprising what one is finding, and looking at that elsewhere in the region. So that's the project I'm working on now. And for the moment, it's appearing in shorter forms, but I think it'll be a next book.
Great. Well, Brian, thank you so much. Good luck on that. We hope we can maybe have you back and talk more.
Thanks, Christian. I really appreciated the time to talk to you.
That was my conversation with Brian Edwards about his wonderful new book, After the American Century, The Ends of U.S. Culture in the Middle East, published with Columbia University Press in 2015. Thanks again for listening to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies.